Welcome back to Open Line, the WOSU 820. I'm Freddie Enderle. This hour on the show, we learn how to communicate with one another in a way that is compassionate, a way that is not condemning, not judgmental, not blaming, a way that helps us discover what our true needs are in our personal relationships, in our work relationships, and also find out what others' needs are and address them kindly. My guest is educator Marshall Rosenberg. He believes that it is our nature to enjoy giving and receiving in a compassionate manner. And he says he's been preoccupied most of his life with two questions. And they are, what happens to disconnect us from our compassionate nature, leading us sometimes to behave violently and exploitively? And conversely, what allows some people to stay connected to their compassionate nature under even the most trying circumstances? And he says that when he studied the factors that affect our ability to stay compassionate, he was struck by the crucial role of language and our use of words. He writes that he has identified, in fact, a specific approach to communicating, that is to speaking and listening, that leads us to give from the heart, connecting us with ourselves and with each other in a way that allows our natural compassion to flourish. And that approach, my guest calls nonviolent communication. We'll find out more this hour. Marshall Rosenberg is the founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. He travels throughout the world mediating conflict and promoting peace. Among his books, Nonviolent Communication and Speak Peace in a World of Conflict. Welcome to Columbus and to Open Line, Marshall Rosenberg. Good to have you here.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, and I liked your quick summary of what I offer.
Well, thank you. We're at 614-292-8513, if you'd like to join us with questions or comments. Marshall, what I like is that you believe that fundamentally we want to treat each other and be treated with kindness and compassion, that is our fundamental nature. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I see that in my work regularly. For example, in mediating between tribes in Africa where they've been killing each other regularly, it is amazing and hopeful to me that if I can get the leaders from both sides into a room and just get them to see each other's needs, just to see each other's humanness, it's amazing how things can transform.
Because I guess at heart we all have the same needs. I mean, we want to live a peaceful life. We want to be happy. We want our families to be successful. We want to be safe. I mean, all of those things we share, no matter what side of a fence we're on. Huh?
Needs are never the source of the conflict. The conflict comes by how we want to fulfill our needs, the strategies. That's where the problem comes in. Mm-hmm. But when people start off right away arguing over who's going to do what, then they're not going to like the result. But if they can first connect with what each other needs, then they see that the needs are the same for everybody, not that we have them at the same time. But we can see the other person's humanness when we see their needs. Then the strategies to find ways of getting everybody's needs met are not that hard.
So if we listen, is one of the potentials then, and one of the hallmarks of nonviolent communication, compassionate communication, is that to simply listen to, first of all, to express what we need in a conversation, let's say, and then also listen to what the other person needs.
Even when the other person expresses it in a way that makes it a challenge to hear the needs, because unfortunately, many of us have been educated not to know how to say what's alive in us, what we're feeling, what we're needing. We have been taught to blame and criticize. So in our training, we show people how even if the other person is coming from that blaming and criticizing way of expression, to hear the needs behind it. Because the central premise of our work is that all criticism and all blame is a tragic distortion of what the speaker is needing.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody is criticizing me about my behavior or in a conversation or blaming me for a discord between us, it would be more productive and more human and more humane if I look behind and beyond the blame and the criticism and find out what that other person really needs. How do I do that?
Well, by first being conscious that all that criticism is simply a distortion of a need. And we guess then what that need might be behind it. And the context often helps us to guess what the need might be. And we only have about 9 needs as human beings, according to the Chilean economist Manfred Max Neef. So all we need is a vocabulary of about 9 needs. And if somebody is criticizing, seems to be criticizing, then we just have to kind of sense Which of those needs is this person trying to bring to my attention?
So let's say a wife says to her husband, you never listen to me, and when I speak, you never take me seriously.
And if I'm the husband using nonviolent communication, I might say, if I'm hearing you right, it's very painful when your need for understanding isn't getting met.
Mm-hmm. And then this gives an opportunity for the woman to say,
Yes, or no, that isn't it. But then mm-hmm. if it isn't it, it really helps the person to get more clear about what their needs are.
Mm-hmm. You say that there are kinds of communications, and one of them, I guess, is blaming, that block any kind of compassionate communication. And making first of all, moralistic judgment is one category you have. And I can imagine that would put people off if I say to somebody I'm working with or somebody in my personal life at home, you're at fault here. You did this wrong, and you continue to do it wrong. That's a judgment. It's a moralistic judgment, I guess.
Yes, and I think it has also problems to say to somebody, you're wonderful. You're the nicest person. You are so kind. You are competent. Because praise and compliments are the other side of this violent language.
How does that work? Now, that's surprising to me, because I would say if you say to somebody, gee, you're a wonderful person. I just love being around you. You're terrific. That would seem to be an open-hearted expression, but not necessarily.
We show people how to say it even more beautifully. You see, when you say to somebody, you're wonderful, unfortunately, people have had parents, teachers, and managers in their work setting that use praise and compliments as manipulations to get you to work more. Teachers that I work with say that they have been told that if you praise and compliment students daily, they work harder. Managers in industry have the same belief. And they show me research that proves that. And I say, take another look at the research. You'll see that that only works for a short time until people sense the manipulation of the praise and compliments. So that's one problem with it. The other is, it's vague language. It doesn't really say if it's sincere, if it's not a manipulation. It doesn't really say how the speaker's needs have been met by what the other person has done. And that's what really has life in it. Not to tell the other person what they are, but to say, you know, when you offered to drive me to the store knowing about my car being broken, I felt so relieved because I had a need to get food for the family, to visit my mother in the hospital, and I just felt such support. So notice that kind of gratitude is not a compliment. It's saying how your life has been enriched by what the other person does.
Mm-hmm.
I've asked lots of people around the world. I've shown them the difference between these two and say, of the two, if you could have a compliment, would you rather have that, or would you rather have the person tell you honestly what needs of theirs were met and how they feel? And I've never had anybody yet tell me they'd pick a compliment when they see those two possibilities.
So when a boss says to a subordinate, that report you turned in the other day was very well written, and I'm very happy about that because I was feeling a lot of pressure from my supervisor to have a well-written report here, and you helped me alleviate some stress because when I handed it to him, he liked it too.
That would be pretty good, except for that it was well written. If you said, I admired how it was written, you're talking about your values.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say it was well written, you're using a language that implies you are a judge of what is and what isn't well written.
How could I say that better?
I liked how it was written. My need for clarity was met by how it was written.
Mm-hmm.
My need for humor was met by some of the funny things you put in there.
All right. So be specific and try to say precisely in that case what it is I like about this report rather than a vague phrase like, well, it was well written. Yeah.
And just to generally be concerned about the verb to be when it's used to tell people what they are. You know, I work with cultures around the world that do not have such language. They can't say that you are kind or unkind. And such cultures have far less violence because they have a language of life, a language that just helps them to share what's alive in themselves and what would make life better. They can only hear what's alive in other people and what would make life better for them. They don't live in a world of good guys and bad guys.
So in other words, they literally don't have the words to express a generality like you're a kind person or an unkind person?
No, several cultures throughout the world, if you read the Ruth Benedict, the anthropologist, or Margaret Mead, who describes such cultures. I've worked in Malaysia with one, the Orang Asli people. It's a whole different culture when your brain hasn't been programmed to judge, you know, the other person in a way that implies you know who's good and who's bad. Because, you see, those judgments are part of a very destructive judicial system that implies that if you get a certain judgment, you deserve to be rewarded, and the other, a punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And much of our violence comes that's how we've been defining justice for several centuries.
My guest, Marshall Rosenberg, is the founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. He travels throughout the world mediating conflict and promoting peace. Among his books, Nonviolent Communication and Speak Peace in a World of Conflict. Marshall, when you talk about the four qualities of compassionate communication, you say, first of all, observe yourself and the other person without evaluating the other person, or in fact, without evaluating ourselves. Because you say evaluation sounds like criticism. So tell us a little more about that.
Well, what we suggest is to keep two things separate. Keep separate observation from evaluation. So if somebody says to another person, you're rude, you see, we would suggest to that person, if you can be specific, what about the other person's behavior are you referring? The more they can hear a concrete observation, the clearer the communication.
Mm-hmm.
So we show people first how to separate observation and evaluation. Then we suggest if you're going to evaluate, telling people what they are is less likely to get your needs met than if you tell the person what your needs are
mm-hmm.
that aren't being met by that behavior, and you tell them how you feel as a result of that. So that's telling people what's alive in us. You see, what's the most frequent question asked around the world? When people get together, how are you? You see, now our way of saying that is what's alive in you. This is a natural human question. If we want to live in peace, we have to have a culture in which people care about what's alive in each other, how they are. So nonviolent communication suggests evaluating that way. Tell people how you are, what you feel, what needs of yours are being met or not met. And then follow it up with a request. If your needs aren't being met, tell the person what they could do to make life better for you.
So, for example, if I were to say to somebody, you've been very rude, and I want you to stop that behavior right now, that's not going to be very effective. But if I say, when I said something to you a few minutes ago and you rolled your eyes and made this sort of sound in your mouth that sounded to me like a disapproving sound, that felt to me very rude and dismissive. And when you did that, I felt very angry, and I'm a person who values communication and a relationship not being so angry. So I'd like to know maybe why you did that, and I'd like also to ask you if there's any way you could not do that in the future. Is there another way you can tell me what you need?
Well, we're getting there, but you said you were angry.
Yeah.
And when you're angry, that means you still have in your head judgments that what the other person did was wrong, bad,
mm-hmm.
stupid, inappropriate, rude, right. or something like that.
Right.
So when you come from that energy, even if you mechanically use the process of nonviolent communication, it's still not nonviolent communication. Because we don't open our mouth in nonviolent communication until we're sure we have transformed all the judgments in our head that make us angry into unmet needs. And when we're really connected to the needs of ours that aren't met, we can't be angry. So that's one thing. The other thing is the number of words you used was more than most people can hear. So when we're usually using nonviolent communication, we can say all that we need to say in about 40 words or less.
Uh-huh.
Clear observation, how we feel, needed isn't getting met, and a present request, 40 words or less.
Tell me, Marshall, then, if I were to say in the context of that quote, when you roll your eyes that way and make that sound, it makes me angry. What would
no,
be...
it doesn't. It makes me.
Oh, that's not a good
because,
idea. I become angry.
I become angry because I. See, whenever we express a feeling in nonviolent communication, we make it clear to the other person we're not blaming them for it.
Okay.
So it's, I feel angry because I am thinking thoughts that make me angry.
Mm-hmm.
Not that your behavior can make me angry. I've known that since I was about 6 years old. Where I grew up in Detroit, We used to have a little poem. If somebody called you a name, we'd say, "Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me." But we forgot that as we were educated in a culture that uses guilt to manipulate people, where adults say to a child, "That disappoints me when you don't get your work done," or "You hurt my feelings when you did that." So when we want to use guilt in this violent way, then you have to miseducate people to think that other people's behavior is what causes our feelings, rather than what's alive in us.
Well, so if I were to say in this context, when you roll your eyes heavenward that way and you make this sound, I become angry. I generate that feeling in myself, possibly because in my experience, going back to, and again, I'm using a lot of words here, going back to early childhood, that kind of behavior, you know, triggers me, and it just does, and that's, I'll own that, but is there any other way you could express yourself in this conversation?
The first thing I'd do if I'm angry is I'd shut up.
Oh, yeah, you want to shut up and maybe give it 24 hours, huh?
No, about 20 seconds.
20 seconds,
in
okay.
20 seconds, we train people how, when you're angry, to become conscious of the judgment in your head that's making you angry. We get angry when we think life-alienated, violence-provocative thoughts. That is, thoughts that are disconnected from our needs, but imply badness of other people of a kind that they deserve to suffer. So when I'm thinking that way, which we have been programmed in for several centuries, I want to transform that, because every time I transform that thinking, I'm contributing to making peace on our planet. The more that we translate that kind of thinking, the more we're going to have peace on the planet. So I see what I'm telling myself when I'm angry.
Right.
It's usually, you know, "You idiot, what's wrong with you? How could you do such a thing? Bum, bum, bum." Then I take a deep breath and remember that, what is my need that's distorting? What need of mine isn't getting met? And I'll know I'm getting in touch with the need, because now the anger will be transformed into other feelings. Sadness, hurt, fear, disappointment. Then I open my mouth and I say, "You know, when you roll your eyes that way, I feel very frustrated because I really have a need for connection with you. And I don't really know what's going on in you when you do that. Would you tell me how you feel?"
Might you also say to that person, if it were true, that it makes me feel sad because
make me feel sad.
Okay. I feel sad because I would like to connect with you rather than be at odds with you?
Yeah.
That's very vulnerable. That's risky, isn't it?
We need to be vulnerable if we want to use nonviolent communication, but we also teach people how not to fear whatever comes back. So, yes, we're vulnerable, but we only have to worry if the other person criticizes or blames us if we're vulnerable, and we forget to transform their judgment into their needs.
Some people might say, "Well, fine, I'll try that for my closest friends and family, but wow, I'm not going to expose myself that way in a work setting."
Well, that's what we hear from a lot of people, and we simply say, "We'll show you how to do it in whatever setting you want."
Mm-hmm.
We can do this in any setting. And the ones that are the scariest to do and the hardest are sometimes the ones that we need most to do it. So, for example, in a work setting, if I really can't stand my boss, but I don't hear people in my organization talking at this level, of course it's scary, and we need to be vulnerable because this other person has the power to fire me or punish me. But those are very often the situations, if we're not able to communicate in the way I'm talking, it creates a lot of pain for us in the long run.
Marshall Rosenberg with us this hour. He's the founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication, which is exactly precisely what we're talking about this hour, nonviolent communication, compassionate communication. And your calls at 614-292-8513. Here's Jeff on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon, Fred. I've been listening to this conversation, and it's been very interesting. Last year, I had a friendship of mine that's going on since high school ended rather nastily. And this person lives in another state, and I live, of course, in Ohio, so there's no way we're going to sit down and be able to talk about it anytime soon. And I've been trying to figure out what the best way to approach it is. Initially, I wrote a letter to her, and it was a very angry, guilt-trip letter. And basically, casting all these aspersions on her. I never sent the letter. I ended up putting it in the drawer. But now that was back in October. Here we are hitting it in February. And I'm trying to think now, maybe now that some little time has passed, what's the best way to try to, I don't know, either bridge, they'll try to bring some closure to it, or see if there's any way to thaw the chill that's come down between us?
Well, if I was to write her or talk to her on the phone or in person, I would start with empathy, if I could. And what I mean by empathy is I would guess what pain was in her that leads her not to want to be in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And what behavior on my part might have stimulated that. And so that kind of conversation might start like this. If she's willing to answer my phone call, I might say, I wonder if you're still reacting to when I forgot the time that we were going to be together and I planned other things, and you're still feeling hurt about that because your need for trust didn't get met. And then I'd stop and see if I really was connecting to what's still alive in her in relationship to that. Is that clear?
Yeah, it does. It makes sense.
Now, that might be wrong, but notice even if I didn't guess right, it communicates a very powerful thing to this other person, that I care about what's alive in them. And if I happen to guess wrong, it usually helps them get clearer what was going on in them that led them to not want to be with me anymore.
I see.
Make sense, Jeff?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much, Fred.
Okay, Jeff. Thanks for your call. Marcia, you say one of the things we want to do in when we're in a communication that we want to remain open and caring and compassionate is to identify our feelings and then to express them. But you say we might have a lot of trouble identifying our feelings.
And needs. They go together. The feelings without the needs don't say much because the feelings are simply a manifestation of what's happening to the needs.
Mm-hmm.
When our needs are getting fulfilled, we feel pleasureful feelings. When they're not fulfilled, we feel painful feelings. But the feelings by themselves are not enough. We need to connect them to a need.
And my need, let's say, in a particular relationship, in a particular conversation, is to have an open, caring relationship. And at that point in the conversation, perhaps I think that I don't have that. And that I would let the other person know that that's what I need, right?
And then I'd not only let them know that's what I need, but you got to be clear the difference between a need and a request.
Mm-hmm.
Once I make the need, I need to quickly follow it with a present request, what I want from them at this moment mm-hmm. in relationship to that. So if I say, you know, I'm very disappointed, my need for closeness is not being met in our relationship. Now, if I stop at that point, I'm likely not to enjoy where that conversation goes. So I've got to end on a clear, present request. What do I want from the person at this moment? So that might sound like this. You know, I'm really sad and disappointed because my need for closeness isn't being met in our relationship. I'd like you to tell me, for example, right now, how you feel when I say this to you.
Mm. And then finally, and that would be a specific request, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That takes place in the now. Notice if I say, I'd like us to have more open communications together. That's
yes.
a wish for the future.
Mm-hmm. Pretty general, yeah.
That's not what I want right now from this person in the conversation.
All right. We're going to pause here for just a couple of minutes of announcements. My guest, Marshall Rosenberg, founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. We'll be back after these messages at WISU 820. Your all-day NPR news station.
Next time on Day to Day.
Tiny green creatures have invaded North America.
Spreading about 15 to 20 miles a year.
They're emerald ash borers, and they have a big appetite for ash trees.
It has the ability to affect the entire genus.
Can they be stopped? Another insect may offer a solution straight out of a horror film.
Think of Alien, if you remember the movie.
Finding a way to keep some bugs at bay.
Next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day will be here in just about 30 minutes, beginning at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. This is an encore presentation of the Best of Open Line. No phone calls, please. Currently, it is 57 degrees at 11:30. Your membership with WOSU provides for the news and information you rely on. And in this pivotal election year, your support is more important than ever. Becoming a member is easy when you go online to wosu.org/give. And thank you for your continued support of WOSU 820, NPR News. On your drive home, catch up on the day's events and business news with All Things Considered and Marketplace. Now on WOSU 89.7 FM, weekdays from 4 until 7 o'clock.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, Meijer is helping customers identify and select non-invasive plants for Ohio backyards. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. I'm Fred Anderle. We're learning how to communicate with one another in a way that is compassionate, a way that's not condemning or judgmental or blaming, a way that helps us connect with the person with whom we're communicating on a heart level and helps us discover what our true needs are and what their needs are and helps us address ourselves and others kindly. Again, Marshall Rosenberg, the founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. Among his books, Nonviolent Communication and Speak Peace in a World of Conflict. Your questions and comments, 614-292-8513. So, Marshall, then, understand how we're feeling in a particular exchange and what our needs are, what we want, then we communicate to this other person something specific that we would like them to do, a request, and of course important that that not be a demand, huh?
Yes, and we'll know whether it's a demand by how we deal with the other person if they choose not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a child of ours and I say, hey, I would appreciate some support in keeping the house in order, would you be willing to go in your room and make the bed and pick the things up from the floor? And the child says, no! Now, whether what I made was a request or a demand will be how I deal with that no.
If it's a request, how do you deal with it?
I try to hear the need behind the no, because in our training, we make people conscious that a no is a poor expression of a yes. That when a person says no like that, it means a need of theirs would not be met to do what we are requesting. So if the no was said with that tone of voice, I would guess that the need is for autonomy, that they're hearing that they're being forced. But, of course, if the child is 4 or 5, they may not know the word autonomy, so I might put it this way. Are you annoyed right now because you want to do things when you choose to do it and not when you're forced to do it? And the child says, yeah. And I might say, how could I let you know what I would like so it doesn't sound like I'm forcing you? So I would want to work that out with the person.
Hmm. Would you have to be open if this is a request and not a demand that even after all this working out, that you still might not get what you want?
Well, of course, that is always the case in every situation. The one thing my children taught me from the time they were very young, I could not make them do anything. All I could do is try to make them wish they had.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I would do that, they'd make me wish I hadn't made them wish they had. So whether the person is 2 or 22, you can't make them do anything.
Sure. Let's go back to our phones. Our next caller is Lee. Hello, Lee.
Yes, Fred and guests. When is the time that you just let the relationship go other than family and work people? I've had very defensive reactions where they would invalidate me and say, you're imagining things. I didn't do that. And if that's on you, that's not on me.
I mean, that's the response you get when you...
Right. Are concerned. The problem.
Yeah.
You would leave the relationship when it met your needs to do that, when you decided, well, my needs for connection and closeness are not being met, my needs for trust are not being met, so I'm going to choose to try to find another relationship in which I can better meet my needs. What you wouldn't do is blame this on the other person or say you can't talk to that person. You take responsibility by just saying, well, I'm not getting my needs met here. I'm going to try to get them met somewhere else.
Other than with family, and I know work, you have to resolve that, but what about family?
Even in family, If I get frustrated because my best way that I communicate still isn't getting me connected to this other person, very often it helps if I can find a third party who can help us hear each other's needs. Because sometimes we've been into something with somebody for so long that it is a real stress to get past that, those kind of judgments that we have of each other. And there, getting a third sider in can often help.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Lee, thanks for your call this morning. On to Carol. Hello, Carol.
Oh, hi, Fred. Oh, hi. A guest, Mr. Rosenberg?
Yeah.
Are you talking one-on-one, or are you talking groups, too?
Well, I'm talking groups, too.
Okay. First of all, the way I always figured out how to solve my daughter's room's problem was just keep the door closed. Just keep their doors closed, and it's their place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can do whatever you want to do in there, but just keep the door closed.
Mm-hmm.
It works every time.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never have to clean it.
Okay.
Okay. I'd like to talk about groups. Minority groups such as Afro-Americans, women, gays, who have been put down since year one. There are camps. And the camps aren't going to switch sides or agree with the other side. How in the world do you go about this?
Well, I've had a lot of experience with that because in my career in the last 35 years, as you well know, there's a lot of that stuff going on all over the world.
I know.
So I was traveling for about 10 years in the United States in the South, dealing with racism, traveling with a group of people from a street gang that I had worked with, and we were working with groups to share with them our pain when we saw, we made clear observations of what we saw were not contributing to the safety and justice of certain groups. Now there, of course, when you're dealing with a group, you've got to get used to dealing with not one person judging at you and screaming what's wrong with you, but when you're dealing with a whole group. So you better be real good then at learning how to hear the human behind all of the attacks that come at you. We would train ourselves and other people to do that, when there's a whole group screaming at you, how to empathize with them, how to hear their pain, how to hear what their needs are. And thank goodness, whenever we found that when we could see them as human beings, not label them racist or sexist, if we could just try to hear their humanness, then they could hear our pain when we saw that the needs of certain groups were not being met.
Well, these groups have been put down since the year one.
Yes, so I had to first do a little bit of what the Joanna Macy calls despair work to really give them a lot of empathy for how painful it's been to live under oppressive conditions. And then when they get the empathy that they need, then we train them how now to go out. And now let's empathize with these people that are causing the oppression. And let's see their humanness, because if we can see their humanness when we connect with them, we have a better chance of radically changing the situation. Now, I'm not saying that's easy. I'm not saying at times it isn't scary, but I'm saying if we can avoid seeing such people as enemies, if we don't label and judge them racist, sexist, if we can try to see their humanness and connect with it, it's been my experience, they are most then open to change.
Mm-hmm. Carol, thanks for your questions.
Thank you.
Marshall, you've worked with Israelis and Palestinians, right? And
yes.
That seems like a situation where there's a lot of blame being cast back and forth.
Yes, I'm doing a lot of work now in that region, not just in Israelis and Palestinians, but we're doing some work now with Iraqis, and we're doing work with some Indian people who are very concerned about the caste system there. And so we're dealing in many countries where we have some groups who are very, and then also Burundi, we're doing a lot of work now. And in each of those countries, some people have been educated to label others as less than human.
Hmm.
And that's rather sad. It's sad for the person that thinks that way, as well as to the person being oppressed.
Yeah. So, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So we try to find the people within the country from both sides that we can pull together as a team and work on these issues.
Mm-hmm. There must be on both sides of a situation like that just an awful lot of pain inside those people that maybe needs to be identified and compassionately explored. Would that be right?
Yes, like recently brought to the United States to an intensive training that we did in New Mexico. Three people labeled as untouchables in India who have been through great, great pain in their lives, being seen that even their shadows can't fall on other people. They can't drink from the same water bins as other people. When you've been raised that way since childhood, it's not easy to see yourself as a beautiful human being. Mm. So in our training, we help these people, first of all, to see this internal oppression that they've taken inside. They see themselves as untouchable, so we get them past that. And now we have these three people going out and working with large numbers of people from their caste to liberate themselves from this oppressive internal programming. And now they've got that to the point that they're going out and working with the group that's causing the oppression and connecting with them in a way that liberates the other people from these oppressive views.
Because they need to be liberated too, right? The person who
they
has
suffer, the oppressor suffers as much as the person being oppressed.
Yeah. You know, it just seems that many of our cultures almost teach us precisely the wrong things in this regard, right? Teach us to label other people, to blame other people, to react defensively, to react angrily initially rather than exploring what might be behind that anger. It seems like we get entirely the wrong training.
Well, as the theologian Walter Wink says, we have been educated for several centuries to make violence enjoyable. That's why, and when children are watching television in the evening, in more than half the programs they watch, the hero either kills somebody or beats them up. And to maintain that kind of system, you need to educate people to think that there are such things as good guys and bad guys, and that the good guys deserve to be rewarded, get medals, get praise, and the bad guys deserve to be killed or suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Educate people that way, and you're going to have the violence that we have.
You will have warfare, ultimately. Huh?
Yes.
Yeah. My guest, Marshall Rosenberg, is the founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication, which is precisely the kind of communication we're talking about this hour. If you'd like to talk with Marshall Rosenberg on the air, 614-292-8513. And we have a listener on the line. Hi, listener.
Yeah, so Dave, a comment question for Marshall. The concept he has that there really is no such thing as good and bad people. Much of the techniques that he uses are very worthwhile, and they do work, you know, within personal communications. However, there's a however with that. It's been my life experience, and also just, you know, reading history, that at any point in time, you know, there is such a thing as good and bad people. I don't use that meaning with any particular, you know, political or ideological good and bad. It's just the way that they act at a particular time. And those people, take a person who we would call the bad, if you communicate with them using, you know, the concepts and ideals that Marshall uses, those people often just simply do not respond positively to that type of communication. And you need to have another methodology to deal with those people. You know, history is full of examples of where we try to talk with, you know, groups of people, either individuals or whole nations, and they simply did not respond to that. And when we did not have another method to deal with them that might include using violence, you know, and the worst case scenario was millions of people. So you deal with people of all stripes the same way and get the same results all the time.
Okay.
Well, first of all, we are in agreement that there are people doing things that scare us and terrify us and go directly against our basic values. And we find that when we think in that way rather than implying that wrongness or badness of the other person. We're far better able to deal with a situation where there's going to be less violence. For example, we do lots of work in prisons in different countries, and when I'm in these working with people, some of them have certainly been labeled as bad people. An example was I was in Sweden, and they put a new person in my group. The director of the prison said, "Marshal, we hope we don't mind our putting this man in your group. We like how the other men have been responding to your training. That the person we put in your group, people say, is unreachable, that he is really a very bad person. We know he's killed 4 people. One report says 9. I personally believe 8. And then I said to the person, the prison director, "Never mind the math lesson. Anything over 0, I'm scared." So, yes, I can be very scared of such people. So now, for the first 2 days, we didn't get anywhere. Why? Because in my head, I saw him as a monster. I didn't live nonviolent communication. I didn't try to connect with what he was feeling and needing. I didn't honestly share how scared I was of him. And then, guess what? Nothing did happen because I maintained this image of him as a bad person, unreachable. After 2 days, I caught it. I realized that I just had him stereotyped, unreachable, bad, a murderer. On the third morning, as scared as I was, I opened up with him and was honest about what was in my heart. And I said, "You know, when you don't say anything in the sessions, you just sit there staring at me. And when other people have told me some things they think you did to get put in this prison, man, I'm scared to death of you. My need for safety isn't getting met. And I'd like you to tell me right now how you feel when I tell you this." He looked at me and said, "What do you want me to say?" And we start to connect. We start to open up. But yes, as long as I had him in this position of unreachable, you know, sick monster, I'm part of the problem. Now, let me say that we do use force. We recognize that with a guy like this, I didn't want him out on the streets. So we are for the protective use of force, but not the punitive use of force. The protective use of force is to put a person like this in a nonviolent prison. They're put there to protect the public while we can help this person transform.
Yeah, that's more like it. I guess the one thing I didn't say was that I don't mean in the sense that a person is always going to be bad. You know, people can change, you know, either from bad to good or the other way. But the idea that well, you pretty much answered it. The idea that there is no really such thing at any given time, a person can't really be bad, is just not the reality of the universe and the world we live in. And
I'm saying they can behave in a way that we're scared of, and I would rather say it that way than that they are bad, because what we see is what we get. When we see people as bad, we react to them in a way that usually perpetuates the behavior.
Right.
Okay, Colin?
Right, good. Thank you.
Thanks. Marshall, when you said to this prisoner, you shared with him your fear, and he said, "Well, what do you want me to say?" What did you say next?
Just how do you feel about being in here? I'd like your reaction to what I've been presenting to the group. I'd like to connect with you.
Mm-hmm. And what did he do then at that point?
He really started to open up and started to share himself. Mm-hmm. I have really never seen somebody that others and myself even judge as bad that will stay there if we do what we can do, which is to be open and honest with what's alive in us without blaming, and then to hear what's alive in the other person, no matter how they communicate. Now, sometimes I'm with people who are so scared that they only know how to communicate through silence. So if I can stay with that, even when they're not saying anything, I can just reflect back. I'm guessing that you're so scared that it's not easy to talk. I've yet to see a case where if I just stay with that, understanding what I guess is beneath the silence, that they continue to be silent. Eventually, they do open up.
One tendency that I'm seeing in the body politic now that makes me very, or I shouldn't say makes me, right? I'm going to watch that language. The result of which is that I feel very sad is that people are labeling those who disagree with them as bad or evil. they will say, you know, I hate President Bush or I hate Nancy Pelosi. I mean, you'd hear the same thing in the Vietnam War with regard to Lyndon Johnson, for example. And somehow, is there a way that somebody, let's say, could express opposition to the Iraqi war and opposition to President Bush's policies without saying to themselves, of course, they're not going to have a conversation with the president, I'm sure, but they're having a conversation with themselves without saying, I hate that man or this man is evil?
Well, now, I don't mind the hate part as long as the person doesn't just say that by itself. If a person says, I hate George Bush, I'd say, what is he doing that isn't meeting your needs? See, I'd want to help them get clearer about the concrete behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But usually if a person's going to say, I hate him, well, you know, he's a monster. And I said, that's not answering my question. I'd like to know what he's doing that is not meeting your needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's going to be hard for many people because as the philosopher Jaddu Krishnamurti said, the highest form of human intelligence is to observe without evaluating. In other words, just to be clear about what people do before you evaluate them. So then if I can get the person to tell me what George Bush does, then the hatred is okay. Then I'll say, what need of yours isn't getting met? And then after we get that clear, and what are you wanting to do about it? Because just to blame people without getting to the place of what needs of mine aren't getting met and what do I want to do about it? So that's how I handle the people that just give me these vague political judgments.
Would your ideal be, supposing at the end of this discussion, the person said to you, well, I think President Bush, because he started this war in Iraq, from their point of view, they might say without reason, is an evil man. Or they might have said the same thing about President Johnson, in fact, did in the Vietnam War. I mean, that's probably not a conclusion you'd want them to have. Is there another way they could think about it?
I would want everybody to think, what's the good reasons why he's doing what he does? And then they say, are you on his side? And I say, hold it. What I mean by that is, what needs is he trying to meet by doing this? If you see him as a monster, you don't see what needs he's trying to meet, you lose political power because you're forming a stereotype of what somebody is. So if we can try to sense what are his needs that he's trying to meet by doing this, if we can try to empathize with that, we'll be far more powerful when we plan our own political strategies.
And would you then, at that point, would that person have much more empathy with George Bush, even though they may utterly disagree with his actions?
Well, yes, but I skipped one point there. Before this person can hear what I just told you, I would have to give that person a lot of empathy. I wouldn't start off trying to teach them how to express it differently.
Mm-hmm.
When they say, you know, Bush is a whatever, a monster, or I hate George Bush, I would empathize first, meaning I'd try to hear that person's feelings and needs. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I necessarily agree or disagree, but I would hear their needs, give them a chance to express the pain they're feeling when they see some of the things that they believe George Bush is doing. Then after they feel understood by me, then I would tell them, you know, I feel scared when I hear you kind of stereotyping George Bush, and I'd really like you to try to understand what needs he's trying to meet by doing it. And then they're going to say, are you on his side? Are you saying he's right? I'd say, hold it. No, in fact, I'm very scared by what I see George Bush doing. But what I'm saying is if we want to change it, we need to understand, not dehumanize the other side. Mm-hmm. Try to understand what needs they're trying to meet by doing it. And then, if that's in conflict with our needs, then if we plan our strategy from that kind of empathic connection, I think we have far more power to get our needs met.
An empathic connection with the person in political life with whom we radically disagree.
The more I'm scared of somebody, the more I find disgusting what they're doing, the more important it is for me to be able to empathize with what's alive in that person. When I can, I have far more power to influence them.
And would you also be in a better state of mind yourself?
I'll be in an entirely different. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not in pain. I've got a lot of fear and sadness. But coming from that fear and sadness, which is connected to my needs, is a different kind of power than blaming and condemning and wanting to punish that person.
Okay. Let's go back to our callers here. Chris, we have a couple of minutes if you're very quick.
Okay, yeah, I'd just like to commend your guest on his optimism and believing people, you know, want to give and receive compassion and so forth. And I understand in some situations, you know, with the Palestinian Israels, like you said, and murders in prison, or maybe if you're talking to someone about Bush or something, there's a lot of media, you know, middle ground to cover. But in general, I don't think he's very optimistic about people's ability to just fill in the blank and understand that you may not be communicating exactly what you mean, and that's then they, you know, you may, your tone is okay, but your words aren't picked precisely or anything. And also, if I had to talk with people that talked in this vernacular every day, I would go out of my head. I mean, I feel like it's condescending that if they don't spell everything out exactly precisely, then I'm not quite up to par with understanding what they mean. You know, like I'm emotionally inept, that I'm too sensitive. You know, I think most people are pretty resilient. And I just wonder what, if he's ever heard that before, and what he thinks about that.
Yes, this is very important in our training. We show people how to connect at this level where we see what's alive in the other person and they with us. But we teach then what we call street nonviolent communication, which is how to connect in this way, but using a language that is not so foreign to the other person that they have the kind of reaction that you're talking about. So when I work with street gang members, they find nonviolent communication very powerful, but of course they're not going to put it in the language in my book. So we've got to show them how to speak street nonviolent communication. When I'm dealing with a three-year-old, I'm going to use a different communication word-wise, but the process is the same. So we show how to use this in any setting where it doesn't stimulate, you know, the idea that we have a set formula as how you should speak.
Marshall, you say you adopt this culturally, but you say also sometimes some of this goes on nonverbally as well?
Yes, you can very often communicate what's alive in you with a sign, pointing at something. Very often if my wife sees me going out to the kitchen, she doesn't have to verbally express her feelings, needs, and requests. She can just take her hand and move it up toward her mouth in a way that I know that she's thirsty and wants me to get her some water when I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to connect with what's alive in each other. That's the idea, but not to have to do a certain formula and communicate in a rigid way to do that.
Chris, thanks for your call. We have just time to say here that Marshall Rosenberg is the founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. Among his books, Nonviolent Communication and Speak Peace in a World of Conflict. Marshall Rosenberg, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
And thanks to Tom Reynolds at the controls at WOSU 820 AM Columbus. And we're on the web at WOSU.org.